I think if it's too good to be true, you know, if it's such a great story, you know, that's a reason, you know, to pause right there. You know, you can look for his standard motifs, you know, dangers at the shopping mall, you know, sharp objects, maniacs with sharp objects, you know, poisoning food, things like that. You know, so those are things to look for. But I think a fundamental question is, why does somebody do that?
After becoming seriously unwell and blacking out, Sarah spent a night in hospital. She believes she was spiked, but shockingly, through an injection.
I'm Joel Best. I'm a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. My book's about social problems. I wrote a book about missing children called Threatened Children. I wrote a book about a crime called The Random Violence, one about education called The Stupidity Epidemic. I've written three books, I guess, on the use of statistics in talking about social problems. The best known of these, the first one was Damned Lies and Statistics. And I also have a textbook called Social Problems, which they're working on the fifth edition.
I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about the trajectory of your research. How did you come to think about social problems? How did you come to be one of the sort of foremost theorists of social problems as well?
Yeah, I am also the world's leading expert on poisoned Halloween candy.
I say I'm the world's leading expert because I'm the only one. You know?
Professor Joel Best knows a whole lot about Halloween candy, specifically the tales we're told about bad people tampering with trick-or-treaters' loot.
It's conceivable this could happen, but I just don't have any evidence that it ever has happened.
This is Joel Best. He's a professor at the University of Delaware who's been studying reports of strangers tampering with candy for over 30 years.
Oh, less scary.
The tampered candy story has no basis in fact. Two separate reports looked into claims of tampered candy and concluded that virtually all of them were hoaxes. And if a child were killed this way, it would be a major news story. Yet I've never found any evidence of such a story being covered by major media.
You know, when I was in graduate school, it occurred to me that this was a very implausible story, that there were maniacs passing out poison treats to trick-or-treaters. And I eventually wrote a paper about this. And I was at a conference, and I was talking to some people that I knew, and one of them knew about the paper. And he said, tell him about this paper. And I did. One of the other guys said, wow, that's just like Missing Children, which was a big newsy story in the 1980s. And the penny dropped for me. I thought, oh, it is. In fact, it's like child pornography. It's like child sexual abuse. It's like all kinds of things. And I had been aware, I got a copy of Malcolm Spector and John Katsutsis' book Constructing Social Problems when it first came out in 1977. And I looked at it and I thought, this is kind of nutty, because this isn't the way that you teach a social problems class. You know, the standard way to teach it, of course, is to have a chapter, have a week on crime and a week on racism and so on. These guys were doing something different. And I really didn't think about that. And then I went back to that book when I was doing the paper on Halloween. And the paper on Halloween convinced me, you know, and this conversation I had convinced me that, you know, maybe I ought to start paying more attention to this stuff. So I started looking first at Missing Children, because that was what this fellow had suggested. And I wrote some stuff about that, and I got thoroughly hooked, and that's where.
I teach every year two classes on social problems, and a class usually falls around Halloween. And I try very hard to convince the students that maniacs don't go around poisoning children.
This Halloween candy had a needle in it. This one had drugs hidden inside, and this one was laced with poison. And in this video, we're going to be working our way up to the scariest thing that was ever found in Halloween candies. Let's get started with a spiky candy surprise. Imagine going out on Halloween to do some trick-or-treating. You come home, pull out a candy bar from your candy bag. Oh, it's a Twix bar. Nice. You go to take a bite, and ouch, something pokes you on the inside of your cheek. That's what happened to one young girl in Hawaii in 2015. This young girl had a needle in her Twix bar. And it gets even worse. In the same year, there were similar stories of kids finding needles in Nestle Crunch bars and in Snickers bars too. Luckily, these kids got away without injury, but this story could have ended so much worse. Finding needles is bad enough, but you won't believe this next story.
It's a similar thing, as you say, with abducted children. I asked them to give me estimates of how many children go missing every year, and it's thousands in every city. Thousands in every city are abducted by strangers. They're just, you know, plucking them off all over the place. So it's a really difficult thing to kind of dislodge. But could you give, so when it comes to the razor blade and the apple, 1985 paper that you wrote, maybe since then it does happen. I could be wrong. What evidence is there that we shouldn't believe this?
I've updated this every year. Mm-hmm. I have, when I wrote the paper, I looked at press coverage in basically in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or no, I'm sorry, the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, which were the three biggest metropolitan areas. And of course, one's the East Coast, one's in the center of the country, and one's the West Coast. And I, you know, it was kind of a way of studying this. And you know, I couldn't find any evidence that any child had been killed or seriously injured by a contaminated treat picked up in the course of trick or treating. Now, there was a case of a dad who poisoned his child, okay? And he, I think, had heard this story and assumed that the police were just overrun with little dead bodies on Halloween every year and thought that, you know, he took out a life insurance policy on his son, poisoned his son. And the police, and in fact, he was right. The police said, oh, this is one of those Halloween poisons we've been hearing about. And that lasted for about 2 days. Then the police realized, well, there weren't any other kids. This was in Houston, a big city. There weren't any other kids that got poison treats. And gee, the dad just took out this life insurance policy. And we have records that he'd purchased some poison. So, you know, after about 3 days, this was retracted. Now, I don't count that as a case because when parents ask me, is it safe to have my kids go trick-or-treating, they're not saying to me, I'm thinking about poisoning my child. They're the crazy person down the block, you know. So I don't count that case. Now, after this happened and I started doing interviews with reporters, they would ask me, have you updated this? And I realized I had to update it. So I've been updating it every year we're very close to 40 years. So I have a data set that runs from 1958 to 2023. And, you know, the correct conclusion is the same. I can't find any evidence. That is, I don't have a news report of a child who died or was seriously injured from a contaminated treat picked up in the course of trick-or-treating. Now, there have been four other cases of deaths that were initially attributed to this. And within a couple of days, there was a retraction. There was a little boy who got into his uncle's heroin stash. And that was initially attributed to Halloween candy. And then, you know, the police discovered that no, you know, it was the uncle's drugs. And there was a little girl who had, very severe congenital heart problems. And her parents told everybody, she collapsed while trick-or-treating, and her parents told them she's got heart issues. But the press ran with the story that she'd been poisoned. And then the autopsy revealed that, her heart gave out, and so on. Okay. So, you know, I have been giving the same interview. I've given this interview hundreds of times. I've been on national television multiple times. I've been on, countless radio shows, newspapers, documentary films, okay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, what I've learned from this is the importance of modesty, because, you know, it's not like I get the word out and somehow everything changes. People stop worrying about this. I give the same, you know, interview every year. And a lot of times reporters are really surprised. Really? This doesn't happen. You know? So, you know, you realize that, you know, as I like to say, that a contemporary legend is harder to kill than a vampire. You know, it's going to just live on. And giving interviews, to the press is not going to change the fact that people like this story and they want to tell it.
So one of the things that makes something get repeated again and again and again is that it resonates with something. So in spite of the fact that there isn't any evidence that this really happens, you know, that there aren't sort of scores of strangers poisoning children, why is it that we maybe want to believe it? Why is it we go, yeah, that's a thing that happened. I'm going to warn other people about that. Right. What lies behind that?
Yeah, this is speculation, of course. But, you know, we live in a world, we live in a remarkable time in history. You know, this is the best time to be alive worldwide. You know, people's life expectancies are longer. They are more educated. They have more democratic governments. You know, I mean, there's a little fluctuation up and down, but the trend is really great. We live in a really fabulous world, and we are surrounded by people who tell us that this could all come tumbling down. Okay. And a nuclear war could lead to nuclear winter. There are countless environmental catastrophes. The one that we are most interested in today is climate change, of course, but there are lots of others. Economic collapse, global pandemic, asteroid strikes. In the last year, there's been a tremendous fixation on the idea that AI may turn out to destroy all of us. Okay, so these are big problems. Big global problems, and we can't do anything about them. Okay, taking a cloth bag to the supermarket to get your groceries is not going to end climate change. It isn't going to make even the teeniest dent in climate change. So we feel, I think, a kind of anxiety that, you know, on the one hand, things seem pretty good, but golly, they could collapse any minute. And children are the walking, talking future. Okay. And, you know, so we take our anxiety about the future and we say, well, we're going to protect our kids. Okay. And there are lots of reasons we're protecting kids. We have fewer kids than we used to, we have more money to spend protecting kids and so on and so forth. When my sons were little, we put them in a car seat that was the official medically approved car seat for small children. You know, and it was basically made out of tinfoil. You look at it today and you think, God, that's nothing. I used to drive around with my oldest son, and he'd be sitting in his car seat in the front seat next to me facing forward. And we would go on errands and we'd talk about there's a bulldozer, you know, it was great. Okay. And my grandchildren are now encased in these little Kevlar cocoons, okay, which are put in the back seat facing rear, okay, so they can't see any bulldozer or anything like that. And I have no doubt that those car seats are better. You know, I have no doubt that they're safer, and probably deaths from children and auto accidents have dropped, and that's all to the good. But we're doing a lot of stuff to protect kids. And one of the things that we do is we can worry about Halloween. And if you think about it, Halloween is the greatest thing in the world to worry about. Because here's the story. Down the block, there lives somebody who is so crazy that he poisons little children at random. Okay? But he's so tightly wrapped, he only does it one night a year. All right? So, you know, if you're really worried about this, don't let your kids go trick-or-treating. Accompany them when they go trick-or-treating. only let them go to houses that you know about, okay, where you know the people. Inspect the treats when you get home. Go trick-or-treating in the shopping mall. I don't know if you guys have this, but shopping malls in the United States will offer a safe place to trick-or-treat, you know, and of course, you also visit a lot of stores in the process. You can go trunk-or-treating in the church parking lot. Some churches will set up little celebrations. Some schools do this now, too, where people will decorate their cars with, you know, Halloween decorations or other things. And kids can walk from car to car. And the idea is, of course, that no one in our congregation would poison little children. So you can be safe. But you can, you know, you can take whatever precautions you want, okay? And then November 1st, you look around the breakfast table and you count noses and everybody's still there. And you can say, phew, you know, we don't have to worry about that for another 364 days. I mean, what a great thing to worry about, okay? And I think, you know, this is tied to our fears about children's safety, which are tied to the greater anxieties about, you know, just the end of the world. You know, when I was in London in 2020, right before the pandemic hit, I went to the Welcome Center, and they had a big map that was taken from some newspaper article, and it was showing someplace in central England, and it showed the area that four generations of kids in a family had been able to go, and there was the great grandfather was allowed to walk 6 miles to a place where he liked to fish. Okay, when he was 8 years old. Okay, his child, the grandfather, was allowed to walk about a mile. That was the trip. His child, the grandmother, was allowed to walk like, I don't know, 3 blocks or something like that. And then they had this little tiny area, which was the area that the current child, the great grandson, was allowed to walk in. And, you know, you're doing it there. We do the same thing here. We have all of these worries that, when I grew up, the plan was get out of the house, you'd slam the screen door, come back at dinner time. And, it was presumed that we'd be okay. And we were, on rare occasions, we'd show up, you know, with a cut or something that had to have a Band-Aid. But for the most part, it was uneventful. And the assumption now is that that's just too dangerous to allow children to do that.
I think what people will say is that it's better to be safe than sorry, right? Like, what's the harm if things could go wrong. So why not just be safe?
Well, I'm not sure that the best plan is to teach your children that down the block lives a maniac. I'm not sure that's the best way to encourage a sense of community and so on. But okay, I don't try and tell somebody. You know, if you want to check your kids' treats, that's fine. I didn't check my kids' treats.
A related story is the missing children problem. And I find this one to be another interesting one because I can kind of convince people that the Halloween sadist is a figment of people's imaginations. But I find it very, very difficult, especially as a mother of two young children, to explain to people why I am not afraid that someone will abduct them. And it's interesting because I think there are a lot of fears about, you know, the other and about certain groups in society and about social breakdown that all get projected onto this. But this story is ubiquitous, that people are just randomly abducting children. So my husband is Greek and my mother-in-law is Greek. And when I go to Greece with the children, they warn me, if they live in a village. If you go to Athens, be careful. You keep the baby close to you because gypsies steal babies in Athens. There's so much wrapped into that, right? Why would anybody steal a baby? Well, that's just what gypsies do. So it's a certain iteration of this story. When I try to explain that, they're adamant. People will send me news stories of children being just sort of plucked away from their parents at random. So this is a really tricky one.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and of course, it's not that something like that doesn't happen. Okay. Mm-hmm. The prototypical case in the United States was Adam Walsh, who was a 6-year-old boy who went to the shopping mall with his mother, and she was looking at lamps. And, you know, no 6-year-old boy is going to handle looking at lamps for any length of time, you know. And they were in a department store, and he said, "I'm going to go over here and look at the toys." Okay. And she said, "Fine." And she looked at lamps for a while. And then she went to find him, and she couldn't find him. And, you know, eventually they called the police and so on. And his severed head was discovered 6 weeks later. Okay. Now, this is a terrible crime. Okay. You know, this is an awful story. Somebody, you know, kidnapped that kid, and, you know, God knows what they did. And, you know, at a minimum, they beheaded him. And, you know, it's awful. Okay. You know, what you hear when you build a social problem, there's a recipe that has sort of three ingredients. And the first ingredient is you have a terrible story, okay? And it's supposed to scare the pants off you. And you know, you're going, "Oh my God." So here's a story about Adam Walsh, right? And then the second step is you give this a name. And that means that you go from saying this is a terrible incident to saying it's an instance of some larger problem. So the thing would be, here's the story of Adam Walsh. Adam Walsh was a missing child. Okay. So now we've got a category of what this is. And then there would be the third ingredient is you have a number. And usually you want the biggest number that you can to suggest that this is a very big problem, because a big number means there's a big problem. So people most days would say, here's the story of Adam Walsh. Adam Walsh was a missing child. Each year, 2 million children go missing in the United States. Okay. Now, that narrative encourages you to envision a mountain of little hits, right? You know, and in fact, when you looked at this, you know, you discovered that A, there weren't 2 million, there were more like 1 million. And, you know, the great majority of them were runaways. And then there were kids who were kidnapped by family members, often in messy custody disputes. And you get down to the number of children that are taken by a stranger and kept, say, overnight. Okay. And that number falls to, you know, I don't know, 200 a year, something like that. Now, on the one hand, you know, that's not good. I mean, we should understand that, you know, those 200 kids are being harmed, perhaps permanently harmed. They're in danger. They're, you know, these could be little human tragedies. But, you know, on the other hand, currently the United States population is 330 million people. Okay. And so 200 kids that are taken by strangers, you know, it's a relatively small number. It isn't that this never happens, but it's very rare. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to get some kind of perspective. And I think that typically when people are trying to get us worried about a social problem, they fling around very large numbers, which are intended to make us worry about them.
Yeah. I think the response that I usually have to this sort of thing is, not that it never happened, but that it's very, very unlikely. And so my mother-in-law the other day said, "Well, be careful around the park because there are reports of a white van going around and looking for small children." And I was like, "Oh, yeah." But I took my daughter aside and I said, "If anyone comes near you, you scream and you run." That's the extent of it.
Yeah. You know, it's not that we live in a world where there are no dangers, but we don't want to be, we want to teach kids to deal with dangers, to be alert for things and so on. But, you know, we also would like them to grow up. have a sense of confidence that they can go out and meet the world. And you don't want them thinking that the boogeyman is right around the corner every time where they go.
So one of the areas of overlap with social problems is urban legends. And that's mm-hmm. where the sort of the razor blade and the apple comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult sometimes to disentangle what could be a social problem from an urban legend. So one thing that went around recently, and I'd come across a sociologist actually who was studying this, and I should probably look and see if they've published since then, but I'm not sure if you're familiar with reports just toward the tail end of the pandemic about injection spiking.
No.
Yeah. Very interesting. As soon as I heard about it, my, you know, spider senses started to tingle. But it was this idea that people were in mass gatherings injecting people with date rape drugs with a syringe. Visit patreon.com/AshleyAFrawley for part 2.